It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with a splendid table. If you flipped open a cookbook, say 700 years ago, you'd find a recipe maybe for candied turnips. And where we now see nutritional information, in that old recipe you would see a medical note. These turnips are moist to the second degree and warm to the first degree. Also back then, you'd understand that medically, each person and most foods had four humors: wet, dry, hot, and cold. The trick was to match what you needed for health to what you put in your mouth. Well, that kind of balancing is true in Thailand today. So it's dinner as a balancing act and much more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. How many times has a whiff of something brought back a memory so alive that you're back in the middle of it? Wet autumn leaves are like that for me. In a nanosecond, I'm walking to kindergarten. And then it's lunchtime, and I can feel the wax paper and taste the cream cheese and jelly that I brought every single day. Well, that sensation of time travel is the bailiwick of Professor Rachel Herz from Brown University. She researches scent, what it does to our brains and what it does to our emotions and our memories. She's written the book, The Scent of Desire. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Why does that scent evoke such a strong memory for me?
Well, it's probably because, and I love that, by the way, cream cheese and jelly. Does that set you on your food career?
I think it may have.
Anyhow, the reason being is that this is a first association, most likely, that you had to this combination of aroma, cream cheese and jelly, and it was actually at a significant time in your life. The two features here being emotional involvement,
right,
and also first experience. Because with smell, it's the first associations that stay with us. And it's actually very difficult to undo and reassociate a smell to an experience once one has been laid down.
But do smells evoke memories in ways that are really different from, for instance, taste or touch or sight?
Yes. And the way that smell is unique is in the emotional intensity of the memory that it evokes. When we experience a smell-evoked memory, the content of it and various details could be just as accurate or as vivid as if you heard something and recalled the same memory or touched something and recalled the same memory. But when you smell the thing that brings back the memory, your experience of the memory is much more emotionally involved. You feel like your heart beginning to race or whatever the case might be, and you feel more brought back to that original time and place.
Why is that?
Because of the way that our sense of smell is connected in the brain to the areas that process emotion and emotional memories. And in fact, the sense of smell is literally directly linked into the part of the brain where memory and emotion is processed. In fact, that part of the brain is actually considered to be primary olfactory cortex. And no other sensory system has this very uniquely tight connection to emotion and emotional memory except for smell.
I understand that most of what we experience in tasting things is really coming from smell.
Yes, that is correct. And that's because our sense of taste is actually a very simple sense. It is only the five sensations of salt, sour, sweet, bitter, and the fifth one, umami, which is a savory protein-type taste like MSG.
Right.
And everything else that we experience when we eat food comes from our nose. So if you bit into a steak and you hadn't any sense of smell, all you would taste is salt. So that would be very unfortunate. So the smell of the grill and everything else that you get with a wonderful piece of steak comes from two factors of olfaction. One, where you're bringing the fork to your mouth, or you see the steak coming towards you and the smell is coming off the steak, so coming into your nose from the outside. That's called orthonasal olfaction. So you're sniffing in, I smell the steak.
Right.
The second thing that's happening is actually as you're chewing the steak inside your mouth, the volatile chemicals which make up the steak aroma are coming from the back of the mouth into the nose. That's where flavor tends to be experienced, and what people really call taste is actually flavor here, and it's a conjoined experience. So people can't really separate. Like, you can't separate the saltiness of the steak from the aroma component
right.
of the steak. It is all one. And the brain knits together these two facets of sensation to produce what's technically really flavor, although we tend to call it taste.
This is really fascinating stuff.
I'm glad you think so.
No, but it is, because I'm thinking about all of the difficulties that we as a culture have with weight issues and health issues. Can any of this research figure into having people eating healthier?
Well, there could be two components to this issue. One is sort of retraining a thinking connected to smell experience connected to food. And actually, Elizabeth Loftus has done some work where she's made people think that they were sick after eating a particular flavor of ice cream. And the idea being that maybe people would want to avoid that ice cream afterwards, even though they had actually never been sick after eating this ice cream. She inserted a memory into their past. And those who had believed that as a child they had been sick after eating strawberry ice cream were less willing to want to eat ice cream. And she also has done the reverse, where, you know, eating spinach was connected to something good, and therefore the idea that you might be more willing to approach, you know, the greens on your plate. But the other issue is whether or not by smelling food aromas, we can in some ways increase the satiety that we have for a food. So, for instance, you may be hungry to a certain extent, but not really hungry. And the smell of a particular food could actually get you over the hump of wanting to eat it. So, for instance, you've already had lunch, but you've gotten back into the office and someone has a tray of donuts by the coffee machine, and, oh, they look good. Potentially, just by smelling the sweet aroma, you could sort of get enough of an emotional hit to say, okay, that's fine. I actually don't need it. I'm getting the pleasure from the smell itself.
That would be sensational.
Yes.
Rachel, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
Professor Rachel Hertz of Brown University has been researching smell, emotion, and cognition for 17 years. Her book is The Scent of Desire. Well, I got a question from a listener that's a direct tie-in to smell. George in Kalamazoo wants to know how to tell if his herbs and spices are still good. They've evidently been around for a while. A sniff will reveal all. If you can't smell them, they're dead, and they need to be consigned to the rubbish bin. Figure herbs and ground spices have maybe 3 months of prime time in an airtight container that's kept in a cool and dark place. Whole spices, by the way, can go for even a year. Now, your nose can also tell you when a cheese is bad. Before you buy that brie or any other soft cheese, get the package open and take a sniff. If you smell ammonia, the cheese is beyond redemption. You're going to find the same rule applies to meat or poultry that you store tightly wrapped in the fridge. If it's over the hill, you're going to know as soon as you open the package. It's going to smell rank. And trust me, it is better to toss the meat than to get sick. But you can slightly extend the refrigerator life of any meat with air. When you get it home from the store, loosen the packaging around it so that air can circulate, then refrigerate it. It's going to maybe dry out a little bit, but you're not going to get that lousy smell. Maybe you get an extra day from it. It's worth a shot. Jane and Michael Stern have carved out their own specialty in the food world. Others poach on their territory, but nobody's surpassed them. They hunt down the great American hometown eateries, the breed of restaurant that's more elusive every year. Well, Jane and Michael report on their website, roadfood.com, and they come and talk to us. Jane and Michael, welcome.
Hey, Lynn. You know, we were cruising around Tucson looking for good things to eat, and of which that city has plenty. And we saw a little kind of storefront in an inconspicuous shopping mall. And in front of this storefront was a little smart car, you know, one of those little roller skate
right.
type cars.
Yeah, right.
And the smart car had a license plate on it. It was a vanity plate, and it said, Be Vegan. And we thought, this is interesting. And the car was outside of a place called the Tucson Tamale Company. So we went in a little suspicious, because as you may or may not know, Lynn, Jane and I are not vegans. However,
I kind of got that idea. I don't know.
We had to go into a place where this car was parked, and besides which, it's called the Tucson Tamale Company, and tamales are huge in Tucson. And in fact, while there are indeed vegan tamales available at the Tucson Tamale Company, there are also classic tamales and some pretty inventive ones that are not necessarily vegan. In fact, we found some of the best tamales that we've ever had.
You know, it's funny, Michael, because my memory of the best thing I ate at that place was a sirloin steak tamale.
Yes.
I mean,
it was good.
You know, I wouldn't like send every vegan in America to this place.
No, but he does have vegan tamales,
okay,
which is good to know if you happen to be
lard
vegan.
Free.
Everything free. I mean, nothing's
there. There's no reason why you couldn't make
it. Is there just air?
Come on, though. There's no reason. I mean, a tamale can be vegan in a hot minute.
No, it's true. Exactly. No, tamale. And that's the whole point. The guy who runs this place is named Todd Martin, and he sees tamales like the concept of a sandwich. In other words, you can do anything with it. I mean, it can be beefy, it can be vegan, it can be anything. And he does make the classic ones. In the fall, he makes classic green corn tamales. You know,
that's
which are
the fresh corn ones,
with
right?
The fresh corn where the husk is kind of greenish, yeah, and the chilies have just been roasted.
You know, he will do them. Just stop. All right.
Well, you know, I mean, green corn tamales, traditionally they are a strictly seasonal thing because they can be made only when the corn is ripe and the chilies are just roasted. In
right.
fact, nowadays in Tucson, there are places that make them year-round from corn trucked up from southern Mexico and from chilies that have been frozen after the harvest, and those aren't really bad.
Right.
Todd Martin at this place makes them only when he can do it the right and formal way.
You know, it's a tiny little storefront, and one of the problems that Michael and I have with eating tamales in restaurants is they all seem to come from the same, you know, tamale central distribution point.
Right.
And the Tucson Tamale Company, as I said, is a little storefront, and it's kind of a tamale boutique. Things are made in very small quantities with tremendous care given to each one, and I think they are probably the most delicious tamales I've had in Arizona.
And unlike a lot of, you know, many times when you order tamales, you get, say, a half dozen because they're kind of like cigars.
Right.
You know,
they're
the
very
size
small.
Of a cigar.
Yeah.
These
yeah.
are big. Each tamale, I mean, one good sized tamale here is a meal. And besides the tamales, I have to tell you that he makes three or four different salsas, varying from thermonuclear to very mild, some with kind of sort of green chilies, some with red chilies. So the variety of food that you can get in this little place is astonishing.
And there's how many tables would you say? Maybe six?
Maybe
eight
six tables.
Tables.
A lot of the business is takeout because, as you know, Lynn, a tamale is great for bringing home and reheating.
Oh,
it
yeah.
doesn't hurt it at
oh,
all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or for parties.
And for freezers and whatever.
And the list goes on.
Exactly. Guys, thanks.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Hot tamales in the red hot. Yes, she got them a sale. Hot tamales in the red hot. Yes, she got them a sale. Well, I got a gal, she long and tall. She sleeps in the kitchen with her feet in the hall. Hot tamales in the red hot. Yes, she got them a sale. I mean, yes, she got them a sale.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It Is Too Late. Now, you can find the Stern's Road Food Finds anytime. You just go to the trusty website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our weeknight kitchen e-newsletter and our podcasts and our special recipe collection. It's called Cheap Eats. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, are you Earth, Wind, Water, or Fire? Eating in the Thai tradition. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. I think you learn a lot about a people when you try to understand their health traditions. And the further back you go, the deeper you go into cultural beliefs and mentalities. You can't separate them from how people ate. Thousands of years of different food ways start falling into place. Food was a very specific medicine and a spiritual connection for many peoples. And for some, it still is. In Thailand, for instance, there's a system built around the idea of a home element. each person has one of four different kinds. This, and a lot more, determines what and when you eat, essentially how you keep your body and your life in balance. Well, Thai chef and food writer Sue May Yu has been researching food as medicine in her home country. She worked under the guidance of the physician who was head of Thailand's National Institute of Thai Traditional Medicine. Now, she explains those traditions in her book, The Elements of Life, A Contemporary Guide to Thai Recipes and Traditions for Healthier Living. Sue May, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you explain? This system seems a bit complicated. Where does this come from?
Well, it is kind of complicated, even for the Thai people. I think it came from the fact that the old-timers were trying to decide how to keep themselves from getting sick and at the same time cook something that was delicious to eat. So they created this cuisine based on the fact that they had to use whatever nature provided, and they thought it would be a great example if they could follow nature's path. So subsequently, Thai cuisine was developed with this kind of idea. Although today, if you go to a Thai restaurant, eat a plate of pad thai, you had no clue. This is where the foundation of pad thai came from. But it's all there. We don't just eat, you know, a piece of meat, some potatoes, and a salad.
Right.
Every single dish has different layers of various taste, flavor, and aroma. And these all came from different elements from nature that has been studied and tried an experiment and subsequently created into something that we could eat that keeps us well.
Okay, now I think I'm going to have to ask you to back up a little, because could you explain, you've mentioned elements, okay, what are those elements?
Well, it is believed that the universe is made with four elements: earth, water, wind, and fire.
Uh-huh.
Earth is all the solids. Water is, of course, all the liquids,
right.
And wind is the force of air, and fire is the heat. And that in each of us, we also have earth, all the solid parts of us,
mm-hmm.
water, all the fluid within our body, wind is our breath, and fire is our energy and the fuel that fuel us, so that we are exact imprint of the universe herself. At the same time, nature has a predominant element during different season and during different time of day. For example, you are in a freezing cold right now,
right.
And it is believed that that particular season is dominated by the earth element, whereas I live in California and today is very balmy and somewhat dry and cool. It is under the influence of water element. And if we are talking about noontime is influenced by the fire element. So subsequently, we as individual human being also is endowed with either one or two of these what we call home element, and it's given to us at the time we were conceived. And what this means is that when you know who you are, it gives you the knowledge to take care of yourself, to know your vulnerability, and to know what seasons are much more compatible for you, what time of days are more compatible for you, and what time of day or season are much more vulnerable for you, so that you could eat and take good care of yourself in order for you to be in balance within yourself and also with nature.
Now, you have a wheel that comes with the book where you can actually figure out what you call the home element, whether you are
exactly.
Predominantly fire or wind or earth. The idea here is that all of Thai food is balance based on these four elements. But then when you're cooking for someone whose home element is wind, you would include certain ingredients that are for that person, right?
Exactly.
And
exactly.
And you take into account the season, what the environment is, and you take into
yes.
account the time of day.
Yes.
I need a practical
yes.
application.
Okay. Well, for example, right now it's the winter time.
Right.
And we do not expect people in Indiana to be able to go out and look for lemongrass. You know
yes,
what I mean?
Exactly.
Because it's difficult to find lemongrass growing in Indiana. However, you can get things like onion, which are natural to the soil there.
Right.
You could probably get some garlic. Right. You could probably get, all kinds of tubular roots, vegetable.
Mm-hmm.
Potato is a very good food for the wintertime because it suits the taste of the earth element, which consists of buttery, sweet, salty, and astringent. And potato is very buttery. And so subsequently, it is a very good food for the wintertime because it's very good for your muscle and it helps build your energy and it's very good for your digestive system. Now, let's say you are a water person like me.
Okay.
And if I'm going to make mashed potato for myself, what shall I do? Well, water element person should be eating things that are sour, bitter, and bland. And in some way, potato is kind of bland, but winter does not do very well for a water person like me, so I have to make sure that my chest is well taken care of.
Uh-huh.
So that I would make mashed potato, okay, and add probably a little bit more ginger in it, which is warming for my chest.
Right.
But at the same time, I would probably serve something next to mashed potato for myself, such as a salad on the side that has citrus in it that would be good for a water element person. Now, you are, I think we talked about this, you are a fire person.
Yes,
I am. Fire person should eat things such as bland, astringent, and cool and refreshing. And when you make mashed potato, make some mashed parsnip on the side, and when you serve yourself, mix some of the parsnip into your mashed potato, and you'll have what you need for you, and then the earth person could just eat the plain old mashed potato. And then you have a salad on the side for somebody like me who would love to have, some salad on the side. So this is a way you could play with the idea.
So it comes down to following the seasons and being aware of what each person that you feed needs.
Exactly. It's like you are a partner within yourself, but also with Mother Nature.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Sue Mayhew's book is The Elements of Life, a contemporary guide to Thai recipes and traditions for healthier living. Now, Sume explains how to customize a simple dish for each one of our home elements in her recipe for fried rice. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. If you haven't looked at National Geographic since you were a bored 8-year-old at your grandparents' house, brace yourself. Because Geographic is now a traveler's and a food lover's go-to site with a book to back up that statement. It's National Geographic Food Journeys of a Lifetime, 500 Extraordinary Places to Eat Around the Globe. The only problem with this book is it is not portable. You are going to need an extra roll-on. Keith Bellows, who is editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler magazine, joins us from Washington. Keith, welcome.
Pleasure.
Keith, I'd love for you to talk about the things that we overlook when we travel.
Well, I think they're the same things we often overlook in our own backyard. I mean, I live in Washington, and I don't do the tourist stuff. I know the city pretty well, and so I tend to look for things that are where the tourists aren't. What you really want to do is you want to go local. You want to get as close to the sort of the culture of a place as possible. So take, Waterbury, Vermont. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to do there. But, that actually is where Ben & Jerry's was started. It's where the factory is. You can go get your pint of, ice cream there. And it's a really interesting place. You've even got a flavor graveyard there, which is sort of the...
A flavor graveyard?
Yeah, it's where the less successful flavors are sort of memorialized. So it's sort of kind of fun to see behind the scenes. Now, you can go to a place like Germany, where I haven't actually personally been here, but it's a museum of bread culture. And in a nutshell, it's sort of documenting 6,000 years of human history through bread. Now, there's no actual bread in the museum, but it does have a gallery of bread artworks by Picasso and some others. So it's a little unusual.
I didn't know that Picasso worked in bread. What else would you have us do?
Well, and this is especially good if you've got kids along. We've got a whole page in the book dedicated to old-fashioned candy stores. And there's one called Orne's Candy Store in Booth Bay Harbor in Maine. And it opened in 1885, and it pretty much looks like it did then. You know, it's timber-lined store. It's got fishies in a little fishing village. But it's the candy. It's the old-fashioned candy, the saltwater taffy, the hand-dipped chocolates, the brown sugar with walnuts, which is one of their famous fudge flavors. And, you know, it's a real taste of old-time America.
What about, are there other candy stores?
Oh, yes. I actually have been to this one, and it's in Delhi, India. Gantawala Halwai. Now, you want to talk about an old candy store. It opened in 1790. It's been in the same family since then. And if you've been to India, you realize that it is just an incredibly sensuous place. It's full of vibrancy, color, and taste. This is a place that has candies you'll never find anywhere else in the world. They have their own candy, Sohan Alwa, which is made from dried fruits and sprouts and sugar, go figure. But, it's a big seller for them. And they've served, they've served prime ministers and presidents and emperors and the likes of us.
I've seen Indian sweets. In fact, I think it was in Vancouver. And the colors are unbelievable. It's almost day glow.
Yes.
Let's talk about traveling and eating.
Yes. This is important because if you really like to eat, it's a good idea to work it off every day. And so we have a couple of bike tours for foodies. And we've been looking at Argentina a lot because it's relatively inexpensive and a great destination. And Salta Provence, it's an area that is also a very deep in winemaking. Mm-hmm. You start in colonial Salta, and you go through some very remote country, terrific terrain, and very, very demanding on a cyclist. But this is sort of the center of, the winemaking business right around Salta. And, you can have a private tasting at the Estancia Colón, which is sort of high-altitude wines. And then you can make your way, presuming you haven't had too much wine, to a gaucho barbecue or, some regional cuisine, like corn-based locro stew. Mm. But it is high altitude, and it is tough cycling, so you really need to be in shape. But, if you're really fit and you want to eat in a country that right now is one of the hottest countries, I think, in sort of the travel area because it's very inexpensive, relatively speaking.
Right.
That's the place to go.
And the wines are wonderful.
The wines are wonderful.
Keith, thank you.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Keith Bellows is editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler magazine. Now, we've got Keith's travel picks on the website. You know where. SplendidTable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It is time for us to talk. We're opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252 or email at splendidtable.org. Anything goes. Okay, let's see. We've got Tyrone calling from Baltimore. Tyrone, what do you want to talk about?
I have an issue with scrambling eggs and making omelets. That's the problem.
All right, explain what the issue is.
Well, I don't know if I'm heating it up too much, heating the pan up too much, or making too much, or putting too many eggs and not enough milk.
Uh-huh.
Because when I scramble and I have the pan, it's pretty much hot. It's not medium, it's hot.
Uh-huh.
Hot. And then when I scramble, and I'm like, okay, it's fine. It bubbles up like it's supposed to. You pull away from the sides and let the other eggs run from it as well.
Right.
But when it's done, it's pretty much dry. This is just on the scrambled side. And I know my mom and other folks who are, I guess, more evolved than making scrambled eggs and omelets, they are. And it comes out, they're not dry, they're runny, but not runny and like underdone. They're runny in that they're tasty and flavorful. So I'm like wondering, what am I doing wrong? And as far as the omelets are concerned, I think it's an issue with me using frozen rather than fresh vegetables. Because I would use peppers in my omelet sometimes,
uh-huh.
And I would, and it would be frozen. I would let it thaw out. And I'm like, okay, if I'm thinking I'm going to get a nice omelet, only to find out I got me a nice big slime ball that's going to dry out. And I'm like, what am I doing wrong?
Hey, you know what? You've already answered your question. Two things, okay?
Okay.
Eggs are really sensitive to heat. An egg exposed to high heat will stick to that. It will be drawn to that heat, and it will cook so fast, and it will toughen up so quickly, and it will dry out. So the trick is...
That's the issue I get.
Yes, and the trick is you can start out with the heat a little bit on the high side, like medium high.
But
when you get the eggs in the pan, knock it down. Better to take it really slow, because the slower you cook them, and I mean like medium low, the slower you cook them, the more tender they're going to be and the moister. Even if you cook them to well done, but you're cooking them real slow, they're going to be tenderer.
Oh, there's a concept.
There's a concept right there. And it's so easy. And you knew it because you said, you know, my pan's really hot. And the other thing about, you know, ending up with the slime ball, it's the fact that the frozen vegetables, unless you defrost them completely and pat them dry with paper towels so they're bone dry, they're going to throw off a lot of water. And it's just, you can't, it's so hard, especially when you cook them with eggs, because you get soup.
Well, it's almost with, well, frozen anything.
Right.
I let them thaw out, and all the water's gone, and I pat it dry, if not put it through the double sieve, only
right.
to find out that it's still throwing up water. I'm like, what's going on?
Yeah, I think it's best to just start with fresh. I mean,
yeah.
It is the nature of the beast. It's really tricky. And certain vegetables, like onions and peppers, have a lot of water in them naturally. So
okay.
When you freeze, what happens is the cell structure of the vegetable breaks down in the freezing because water expands in freezing. And
like
the
ice.
Yes, exactly. And the water in the cells breaks the cell walls. And so when you defrost, all of that drains away. So, you know, take an extra, it'll be 5 minutes, and chop up the fresh vegetables, and then you're going to make dynamite eggs.
All right. Thank you for telling me what I was doing wrong, even though I may have known it already, but didn't know it. But I got confirmation from Lane Rose of Castle, the cooking doctor, because I know nothing about cooking food. Well,
you know
eggs.
A lot more than you think you do, Tyrone.
Oh, yeah. And I might call back next time because I got a problem with French toast, too.
Absolutely. Call us.
Thank you.
Hey,
bye-bye.
Thanks for a great question.
Uh-huh.
Bye. 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. Or go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question comes out of our talking about candy stores you don't want to miss. The question is, how much sugar does an average American eat in 1 year? And by the way, do not underestimate. We're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to get back to talking with you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252 or go online, splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how much sugar does an average American eat in 1 year? It is a whopping 140 pounds. Now imagine a life-size sculpture of a sugar person and then start munching. That's pretty stunning. And by the way, that figure is from 2005. Scent researcher Dr. Rachel Hertz writes about it in her book, The Scent of Desire. You could say, though, that we can't help ourselves. Now, sugar is something we humans are hardwired to love. It starts in the womb, and it's part of some old survival patterns. Now, there are ways of thinking around this. For instance, instead of 140 pounds a year, think of adults eating a mere 22 teaspoons a day. By the way, teens do an average of 34 teaspoons a day. Now, here's the bad news. One can of soda has 10 teaspoons, and that 10 teaspoons is the maximum amount of sugar we should be eating in an entire day to be healthy. Okay, back to the phones. Reach us via our website, splendidtable.org, or 800-537-5252. We have got Lynn on the line calling from Cincinnati. Hey, Lynn, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I appreciate it. I'm really hoping you can help me with a disaster. The only thing I own from my grandmother is a cast iron skillet that she used the entire time I was growing up. And I've carried this skillet across the country into the southern hemisphere and back, and I think I've ruined it.
What did you do?
The other night after making dinner, I had a hard time scrubbing it off, and my husband tried for a bit, and and I said, well, don't fuss with it too much, sweetheart. I'll just put it in while I self-clean the oven.
Oh.
And he gave me that, he's a scientist, so he gave me that furrowed brow look, and I said, oh, don't worry. My mother says this is how she cleans hers. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
3 hours later, I opened the oven to find a rusted mess. I washed it, I oiled it, I heated it up, re-oiled it, and 4 days later, I still have a rusted mess on my hands.
I think what you're going to have to do is literally take steel wool, coarse steel wool initially, and then you can smooth it out as you go. And you've got to scrub all that rust away. Because you can't cook in it that way. But your instinct is right about, in quotes, the way you season that term, you know, is you have oil in that pan and you put it in a very low oven or over low heat and you let it sit and let the oil essentially, I mean, it sounds so weird to say this, but be absorbed into, for lack of a better term, your husband, the scientist, will roll his eyes at this, the pores of the iron. But you want to do that several times. And yeah, and it's going to take time to build up that glorious slick that, you know, you had from your grandma using it. But start with coarse steel wool, and then as the rust comes off, use fine steel wool and just keep scrubbing away. And get rid of that. Get rid of that rust, because that you can't cook in, and it's always going to, you know, it's always going to interfere.
Right. Am I wrong? I've been seasoning the skillet with olive oil.
I don't think you want to do that, because olive oil can go rancid with a lot of exposure to heat. I would use something like canola, any oil goes rancid, but I think this is a case where you want something that's pretty flavorless and that can take fairly high heat. So you may want to go for canola. You may want to go for peanut oil or grapeseed oil.
Okay.
But when you season it, you want to season it with gentle heat. And a lot of people just fill the skillet with oil and put it in a low oven, like a 250 or 200, and let it sit there for several hours. Then let it sit in the turned off oven until it's completely cool.
Okay.
And then, you know, pour out the oil, and then you can do it again. Or you can do what you're doing. Rub it generously with oil, put it over very low heat, and just let it absorb. And then when you use it, just wipe it out. If anything sticks to it, use a non-abrasive pad to scrub it, and try not to use soap in it. Try to just use hot water, and then dry it with a paper towel, but then put it on very low heat to finish the drying process. And rub it with oil again before you put it away. I always line it with a paper towel. And after a couple of months of this, then you're going to get that buildup back.
Okay.
All right.
Well,
and don't feel bad. We all do stuff like this.
Okay.
You know, I'm the one who put a pan like that away wet.
I imagine.
You know that business about, oh, how do you know all that you know? Because you've made more mistakes than most people have.
This was a biggie. I really appreciate your help.
You are welcome. But it's going to be fine. You're going to be fine.
Okay.
Bye. By the way, just an FYI, I think cast iron is one of the great buys in cookware. You know, for a pan that in any other form might cost you three figures, will cost you maybe $20, maybe $30, and it'll serve you really well. Just take good care of it. And Lynn's pan's going to be fine. Call us, 800-537-5252. James in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, wants to know, what to do with the various types of onion. Yellow, white, sweet, in quotes like Vidalia, green, scallion, etc. Okay, James, there's not a huge difference in flavor between the yellow onions, the white onions, and the red onions. Now, where the difference comes in is in those sweet onions, the Maui, the Walla Walla, the Vidalia, etc. Those onions are best eaten raw or maybe pickled, you know, put them in a little bit of vinegar with spices and that kind of thing and use them as a relish. I don't like to saute them because I think they just bland out. So those are the onions you want to use raw. Wonderful in salads, absolutely delicious as a relish, really great. In fact, you could even candy them, put them in sugar syrup. They're fabulous. As far as the scallions go, scallions are not just more delicate than an onion. They're a completely different animal. One of the things I love to do to scallions is treat them like a vegetable. I grill them. I put them under the broiler. I roll them in a little bit of olive oil, put some salt on them, run them under the broiler or cook them on the grill until they get really brown and they're softened and they're just delicious. You put that next to some crushed new potatoes that you've just poured a little bit of balsamic vinegar on. Not a bad thing at all. So, there's your information, James, and thanks for a great question. Call us, 800-537-5252, or go online, splendidtable.org. Jennifer is on the phone from San Francisco. Jennifer, what can we do for you?
Hi, Lynn. I'm very interested in Auger, the French almond syrup.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a bartender in San Francisco, and I started a company making pre-prohibition-era cocktail ingredients.
What a great idea.
Yeah, so Auger is one of the things that I make, and I started making it because all the products on the market are just basically thickened sugar syrup with almond extract in it.
Right, right, and exactly. And what you're talking about, Auger is it's also called orzata, depending
right,
on what country.
Italy.
Yeah, it is almond milk that's combined with a sugar syrup, and it's used in desserts and drinks and. It has a fascinating history, but go on. What's your question?
Yeah, well, that's actually my question. I originally started with a recipe from the 1860s from an old bartending book, and it does call for making an almond milk and turning that into a syrup, which is how I've been doing it.
Right.
But I'm really interested in kind of researching this, and I know that there are versions in France and in Italy, and you know, when a writer told me that. A Greek sumata is related to it, and I've heard that there's a Dutch version. So I'm kind of interested in putting together a research trip to go to these places and try and find people who are still making it from almond milk rather than with extract.
What a fabulous idea. That is an incredible idea. I love that idea.
Well, yeah, so the thing is, I've heard that in the south of France, this is where that this syrup originates. But in terms of the other countries, I'm not quite sure where to go.
Well, I'm not an expert on this, but I can tell you this because I've done a lot of research into origins of Italian food, you know, and the nature of writing books, and I keep tripping over it. And I think its origins are really the Middle East and maybe India or Iran.
Right.
Because it shows up in Arab confectionery.
Yes.
A long
rose water
time ago. Yeah. There's a book... Out of the East.
Out of the East.
And the author is Paul Friedman. Now, there are many other books, but Paul is a very reliable place to begin.
Okay.
Okay? So that may be a helpful source for you. That book is a starting point and the bibliography. But here's what I know about it. Almond milk, which is essentially where almonds were ground with water, and by the way, actually sometimes with milk.
Right.
But they were ground with water and allowed to soak and then, you know, run through a sieve or run through cloth to make this really rich tasting liquid. This was a sauce that was used in savory food. The famous blanc mange, that is almond milk with sugar and gelatin.
Right.
And it was put in very fancy shapes, and that was popular, gosh, going back to the Middle Ages and before, and right up to, you know, recently. And England is famous for it. This was a confectionery. It was something you drank hot or cold. It was used in pastries. It was used, as you know, in drinks and mixed with other things. It was used in savory sauces, you know, in the days, because up until maybe the 1800s, you had sweet and savory all through the meal.
Right.
So think Middle East, even perhaps the Far East, and that trail may take you down some fascinating paths. You are about to open a fabulous treasure trove.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah, no, you're going to find some wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I've been making some really weird things and doing but, I mean, good, but, you know, stuff that just hasn't been made for a really long time.
Right, and the Romans were using it. I wouldn't be surprised if the ancient Greeks and the ancient Egyptians were, too.
Mm.
So you've got a lot. I mean, you're going to have a ball. And by the way, there's a recipe, in fact, in a book I did, because it's still drunk hot and cold in parts of southern Italy.
Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And people are still making it in their homes. And it's just great.
Yeah, so, that's what I'm hoping to find, is people who are still actually making it from almond milk rather than just using almond extract. You're going to
be the Indiana Jones, you know, of this whole kind of area. I have a feeling you've got a book waiting inside you, girl.
I've been thinking that, but wow, you know, we'll see.
Jennifer, you have a blast.
Thank you so very much, Lynn.
You are welcome.
Okay.
But this is the kind of thing that I think makes food so fascinating, that it's like you find a thread and all of a sudden you're following that thread and it's like all these forks in the road come because you realize one thing, an almond, a nut, and all of a sudden you're in this exotic world of, you know, hundreds of thousands maybe of years ago, and you're traveling through time and you're learning all this fabulous stuff. And I will be quiet now and just suggest that you call 800-537-5252, or you can find us online, splendidtable.org. We humans are endlessly amusing. A friend sent a picture of a sheet cake inscribed, and I'm quoting here, "Congratulations as small as possible," unquote. I picture some harried soul at a bakery taking down the order verbatim. The photo was from a site that's the work of Jen Yates. She collects disaster cakes. She calls her site Cake Rex, and now there's a book, Cake Rex, When Professional Cakes Go Hilariously Wrong. Jen, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Well, Jen, how did you get lured into Cake Rex?
You know, I blame it on my husband, actually. he signed us up for cake decorating classes for Christmas one year, and it was kind of a new hobby, and a friend sent me the image that is now on the cover of the book. It's the very first cake rec I ever posted.
Right.
And it says, "Best wishes, Suzanne. Underneath that, we will miss you."
And underneath is under, and then the word N-E-A-T.
Exactly, yes. It's kind of wrecked to the second power, because they literally inscribed it. It was supposed to say underneath that, but then, of course, it wasn't supposed to say it on the cake.
Yes.
But they wrote it all out. And this just struck me as funny. And one evening, you know, when I got the email, I thought, I wonder if I could find more cakes like this. And if so, wouldn't it be kind of fun to put them on a blog? And away we went from there.
So did you solicit people to send in pictures of cake ricks that they found?
I did. Of course, at first no one was reading it, because I was just doing this as a little hobby for myself and no one else. But when I realized people were starting to read it after a few months, yes, I absolutely said, please send me send me anything you find, because I was looking for them all myself, and that was a bit of work. So now I'm very fortunate that people send them in to me, and it saves me the trouble of finding them myself.
And about how many do you get generally?
We're getting quite a few right now. I think about 50 a day, usually.
Wow.
We'll get, Yeah, it's fabulous.
So what are the rules that actually define a cake wreck?
Define a definition of a cake wreck. Well, you know, the easiest one to say is pretty much any professional cake that makes me laugh. So I reserve ultimate judgment.
I see.
But, you know, there are also things that I post that are actually really well done, like perfectly executed cakes. But it might be of, say, a naked mole rat, or a big foot with oozing toenails, or something like that. And that just makes me laugh, and so I'll put it up.
Okay, let us talk your Cake Rec Hall of Fame, your personal top picks.
Well, I love the misunderstandings. I love any cake where you have to look at it and try and decipher what happened, what went wrong during the ordering process. So for me, one of my top picks, because you know you can't choose just one. I have a new favorite every other day.
Right.
But one of my top picks is the flash drive cake. Now, this is a cake where an office ordered a photo cake. The boss was retiring, and they wanted to get a picture of him on the cake. And the bakery said, absolutely, just bring in the picture you want on a disk or a thumb drive or something. And so they brought it in on a little flash drive. And when they came to pick up the cake the next day, they found a perfectly recreated flash drive on the cake instead of the picture they wanted. It's fantastic. And the best part about that story is that when the bakery offered to fix it, they said no, because they thought it was so hysterical, they just took it as is and used that for the boss's going away cake.
Okay. You know, I'm just flipping through the book, and I'm seeing here a beautifully decorated sheet cake that has written in big letters, nothing.
Yes.
What would you like on this
cake? She wanted nothing
on the
cake.
Nothing on the cake.
Yes.
This is great fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Jen Yates is the author of the picture book Cake Wrecks, When Professional Cakes Go Hilariously Wrong. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this poem from the poet Margaret Sangster. She said, oh, cakes and friends we should choose with care. Not always the plainest cake that's there is the best to eat. And the plainest friend is sometimes the finest in the end. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear and Roger Miller. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a great week. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.